Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware Tech hosted presentations this week on drones and the opportunities they present.
Many of the immediate applications that are out there are all inherently things that save time and money and make things more efficient for both the producer and the consumer.
We chat with one of the drone experts that visited Dell Tech. The Obama administration announced this week it won't pursue oil or gas drilling off the Atlantic coast. We have more on the reaction here in the First State. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also check in with political reporter James Dawson on the week at Legislative Hall and hear what's up at the Playhouse on Rodney Square in our arts playlist. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Earlier this week, Delaware Tech hosted drone specialists and experts at three of its campuses in Stanton, Dover, and Georgetown. At those presentations, the experts provided their insights into the potential drones or unmanned aerial systems have in various business enterprises. Dell Tech President Mark Brainerd said the school believes Delaware has a unique opportunity to become a leader in this emerging industry. Delaware Public Media contributor Larry Nagengast attended one of the presentations and has an in-depth look at what ground was covered in his piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. One of the people he talked to was Sham Chidambar, an American University business professor who works with Flirty Technology, a drone delivery service based in Australia. And he joined me this week to discuss drones now and in the future. I started by asking him if we're just scratching the surface on what drones can do. He said yes, but adds the answer is more complex than that.
I think before we get to that point where we'll get our pizza and Coke those sorts of things, delivered to us at the moment's notice, a lot of things need to happen, technologically, regulation-wise, and so on. But if you sort of push yourself to think about the future, which is fast approaching, we can see boundless number of applications. And the most interesting thing I think that's happening is many of the immediate applications that are out there are all inherently things that save time and money and make things more efficient for both the producer and the consumer, like in movies or agriculture or any number of things like that.
And you mentioned that there's a lot that's kind of moving this along quickly. And like so many other areas, these quick advances in technology related to drones seem to be fueling this rapid growth. What are some of those more recent advances that are kind of opening the door for these potential uses for drones that are kind of changing what drones can actually do?
Oh, I think there's so many components to this rather simple-looking machine. If you open up a drone and see it in front of you, I mean, it seems like a fairly simple device at some level, especially the small hexacopter, quadcopter kind of drones that one sees. But look at some of the components in there, like avionics, right? All the electronics that go in. I mean, the stuff that's making cell phones smaller, smarter, better, the same electronics components are the ones that are used in these things. So every cell phone iteration and evolution is making drones better because the avionics becomes better. Same thing is true for materials, things like carbon fiber and all of those type of things, making huge advances. Kevlar, all those sorts of new material science things are all making components lighter, safer, cheaper, stronger, all of those sorts of things. 3D printing is another one. Several of the propellers that we make for our drones, for example, are 3D printed. So 3D printing is advancing so quickly that, very soon we'll be sort of printing out spare parts for things at home and so on, maybe within a decade. That same technology is being used for, manufacturing some of the components for drones. So 3D printing is another one. Batteries. These things run on batteries. The more lighter batteries you have and, the higher capacity it has, the longer flights can be, the higher payloads it can take and all of those sorts of things, right? Mm-hmm. So everything that's happening in battery technology, whether it's because of Tesla or because of Samsung in phones, that's helping fuel the sort of speed at which drone technology is going to advance. HD cameras, big data, GPS, I mean, you name it, almost every one of the components that goes into big drones small UAVs, as they're called, are remarkably speeding up in terms of innovation and the advances that are going into it, and the materials and the technology that's coming out. So all these, you know, sort of compound one after another, and they're sort of cascading into a effect which makes drones so much more feasible, so much more quickly.
And I would imagine that, you know, drones, you know, unlike maybe some other things, have a lot of these different pieces of technology coming together in one space, where maybe some things like phones or other things rely on a couple, maybe one or two of them. Drones rely on a lot of them, and I guess that kind of makes them a little bit different than maybe some other technologies that are moving quickly right now.
True. I think you make a very valid point. I think so many components are changing, and this is, in a sense, a real engineering story. It's not a software, social media kind of story. Mm-hmm. You know, when lots of people think high tech today, they're thinking about things like that, you know, a social media app or something along those lines, which is purely a software-based phenomenon, which relies on one or two component technologies. But, you know, this is more of an engineering thing. There are so many different aspects to it. And so it's a combination of these things which is making it very powerful. And therefore, you know, there's a complexity to it because of it, no doubt. Plus, it's a physical thing, right? I mean, it's, it's in a sense, it's something that's going to occupy physical space. So it's not a piece of software, you know, on your computer running in the background or something like that. So there's clearly, you know, there's more complexity to it. And safety is a huge issue. Safety in terms of not just privacy and those sorts of things, which everybody talks about, but also physical safety, right? I mean, you have an object which is, let's say, 25 to 30 pounds flying at 20, 30 miles an hour. That's a lot of momentum. If it lands somewhere, it can create some damage. So there's got to be some safety technology built in, and that's a very big part of what drone design is all about, making it safe. In fact, at Flirty, what we're doing is we're working with NASA and folks like that at the very cutting edge to make fail-safe things so that even if the battery fails, the avionics fails, and so on, you will have a soft landing parachute which will bring the drone down and gently land it on harmless sort of soil so that it doesn't create any damage. So, I mean, there are lots of complexity to it. So you're absolutely right. I mean, this the advantage of using all these different components creates lots of opportunities but also lots of challenges.
Well, you mentioned that the safety and the privacy aspects of this, and obviously when you start talking about those things, you start talking about regulation. Various
right.
states are at various points in that process. At that level, the FAA is set to offer some draft regulations this summer. How much of a factor is the regulation piece toward where drones can go next and how quickly they can move?
I think it's completely dependent on how quickly the FAA moves to open up the frontiers of this technology. One thing we sort of realized very early is the FAA runs the most complex, most sophisticated, safest airspace in the entire planet. And they're very proud about that, rightfully so. I mean, we have we've been flying since the Wright brothers, and we've had the safest airspace in the United States. So that's something that they're really proud of, and they hold very dear to their mission. And this is clearly part of it. And they don't want the airspace to get violated and become unsafe for any number of other things, right? So clearly the FAA is going to take measured steps to move this thing along. And until they kind of move and move the bar forward, and they're moving it quickly, actually, we think it's best to stay within the law, work with the FAA, be part of a coalition which sort of works closely with the FAA. We do that through the Small UAV Coalition and a bunch of other industry groups and so forth. We're in constant conversation with them. We work with the UAV test facilities in Virginia and Nevada and so on, so that we are in constant communication with them and we keep advancing it together. The FAA cannot do it without us, and we cannot do it without the FAA. And so we see it as a public-private partnership.
That's drone expert and American University business professor Sham Chidambar, who works with Flirty Technology, an Australian-based drone delivery service. We'll have more of our conversation with him, including a closer look at possible drone uses on the horizon next. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We continue now with our conversation with Sham Chidambar, an American University business professor who works with Flirty Technology, a drone delivery service based in Australia. He was in Delaware earlier this week speaking at Delaware Tech's statewide series of presentations on drones and the business opportunities they present. In this part of our interview, I asked him about where these opportunities lie, both now and down the road. What do you see as some of the more promising uses right now, things that are actually happening or close to happening?
Well, there's so many things that are happening already in limited, confined sort of situation, right? For example, precision agriculture is going on, right? I mean, this is a big thing for Delaware, for example. There's a significant agricultural component to Delaware's economy. It could be of real use in a place like Delaware. Again, based on regulations and the like, precision farming changes the economics of a family farm, makes it more sustainable. They can become profitable and remain in business because it changes the cost structure. They don't have to waste chemicals. They don't have to waste pesticides. They don't have to waste fertilizer, lots of things like that. So those applications are already happening. In fact, the interesting thing is in Japan, they've been doing this for 20 years. 40% of the rice that's grown in Japan is grown using precision farming. Precision farming essentially implies the use of drones. So that's a very big part of what the application space is about immediately. Another one, quite the other side of it, are movies. Movies are kind of expensive productions, as you know. They are using drones to make these wonderful camera angles possible, which they would never have before. And in fact, my favorite example on this is The Sound of Music, when in the opening scene, Julie Andrews sort of sings The Hills Are Alive with The Sound of Music. That movie is about 50 years old now. And when they made that movie, they had people out of choppers, hanging down with a big camera trying to shoot Julie Andrews for that scene. It took them months to do it. And apparently every time the helicopter moved and changed course, the wind draft would knock Julie Andrews to the ground, she being all of 95 pounds or something at that time. And so drones now make that infinitely safer, cheaper, better. And so even in movies like the James Bond movies, where you saw James Bond going through the Grand Market in Istanbul in the previous movie, Skyfall, it's pretty amazing that they could shoot those things. They did that using drones. So a lot of movie producers and movie moguls are now pushing for, allowing drones to be used for movies. Again, they do it under controlled situations, so it's okay. But these things are already in place, and they're already happening. In fact, I think this is June. There's going to be a drone movie festival in New York City, which is movie makers who are meeting to talk about making movies using drones.
Having said that, looking more long-term, are there areas that appear to hold the most promise long-term as this continues to develop?
Absolutely. I think the biggest thing, and this is what we are most excited about, is healthcare. Right? I mean, think about just the number of people's lives you can save, when you have a drone that can immediately bring a blood sample to a test site or one of those things that help you shock the heart back into beating again. Those type of things, right? Any number of things like that. Healthcare. Think about all the U.S. veterans who are not able to get to a VA. You could be able to get them their medications or whatever it might be. And they might be off in a faraway place and not being able to come to a VA regularly. You could send them medication. You could do that in counties where there are people who can't get to the CVS or Walmart or whatever it is where they buy their medications, and the CVS or Walmart could actually send it out to them. In fact, we were talking in Southwest Virginia to the health commissioner, and she was saying there are people in the snowstorms who cannot give their children the very specialized sort of Pediasure, the milk for infants, because they've run out of supply, and that needs to be kept at a particular temperature and so on. And so they don't have like a month's supply with them. They come and buy it on a weekly basis. And usually it's expensive, and these people are not necessarily able to afford it. And some of it comes out of state budgets and so on. And they know where those people are. And they know that they can send them the milk for their child. So these are exciting opportunities to do this sort of thing. I mean, we can really save lives. Think about also all these other situations that are likely to emerge. If there's another Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Sandy kind of situation, or heaven forbid, Fukushima Daiichi kind of disaster, you could take drones and, you know, send it to the last couple of miles to ferry medication, to maybe test things, bring it back, see all kinds of things. The potential is huge. So healthcare, I think, is going to be really, really, really important. And it can revolutionize using this last mile, which is, I think, quite fascinating. I can talk endlessly about that.
Well, finally, I wanted to ask you this. When you do talk to folks about drones, like you did this week at Delaware Tech, what is generally the reaction you're getting, both from the average person and from those who are looking for the potential economic opportunities drones provide?
You know, it's a fascinating question, and I'm glad you asked that. I sort of see two types of people, right? There's one type, which is the sort of, this is never going to work because people will never like it. I'm going to shoot it down if it comes over my house kind of person, right? They think, you know, all the privacy issues are too much, the regulation is too difficult, and, you know, we'll never get around to doing this. And it's too much of interference. And so they don't want to see this happen. They kind of are naysayers, if you will, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the other group, which gets all tickled, excited about it in a flash. And they're thinking about proposing to their girlfriend with a drone coming down with the engagement ring and things like that, right? They get terribly excited about it. So you kind of have an oscillation between somebody who sort of says, this is never going to happen, to I'm going to use this tomorrow to propose to my girlfriend. It runs the spectrum. And then you don't find too many people who are informed about all the stuff that needs to happen in between, right? And that's where I think we, both you as a media person and ourselves as technologists, we have to show that there's a path to that vision that we all seem to share. But we have to do a few things before we get there. So I see a bimodal distribution, as they call it, right? A bunch of real naysayers and a bunch of real technophiles. And not a lot of people in between. I think that's where I think we need to start populating more folks who sort of see that this is going to happen. We need to watch out how we do this. We need to do it carefully. We need to do it correctly. The potential for these things is huge, and I think we can solve the problems going forward. I think that practical sort of side of it has to come across in more people. I don't see that very much.
Our thanks to drone expert and American University business professor Sham Chidambar for his time this week. And again, Delaware Public Media contributor Larry Nangas' piece on drones and their potential is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next up on The Green, a look at reaction to the Obama administration's decision this week not to allow oil and gas drilling off the Atlantic coast. But first, your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm Tom Byrne. The Obama administration announced earlier this week it would not pursue any oil and gas development off the Mid-Atlantic coast in the near future. That decision was widely applauded in the first state, even though there were no plans for any drilling directly off the Delaware coast. Delaware Public Media contributor John Hurdle spent time this week surveying reaction to this drilling decision here in the first state. You can read his piece right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joins us now to tell us more about what he found. John, thanks for joining us on The Green this week.
Hi, Tom.
So first off, tell us a little bit about how Delawareans did respond to this federal government's decision on oil and gas drilling. It seems like there's a pretty strong consensus here.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, what was really striking about the folks that I talked to on this, Tom, was the unanimity of the support for the federal government's decision here. I spoke with seven or eight individuals or organizations, and everybody was very fulsome in their praise of this. This included state and federal lawmakers from both parties. Private citizens, one representative of the tourism industry, which of course would be particularly exposed in the event of any oil spill, and of course the environmental groups were very happy to get this news.
You mentioned the concern about oil spills, and since there were no plans to directly drill off of Delaware, why was that a concern, and what were some maybe the other concerns that people had about this plan?
Well, I think the reason that people were so concerned about it, even though there were no plans for development immediately off Delaware's shore, was that people were so, if you like, scarred by the experience of the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010, and they saw what happened to some of the Louisiana coastline. And I think that people were just super cautious about the idea of ever allowing anything like that to happen to Delaware. And one of the arguments for it, of course, is the great value that the tourism industry has. Economic value for the state, and of course, if there was any suggestion of oil on Delaware's beaches, then that would be disastrous for the industry.
Were there some other concerns beside that tourism concern in terms of an oil spill or a potential disaster type of situation?
Well, I think there was a fair amount of concern about possible damage to wildlife. But one of the points that was raised during the conversations that I had was that, the argument at least was that we really don't need all this oil at the moment. One of the folks I spoke to is Harris McDowell, the chairman of the Energy and Transit Committee in the state Senate. And he said, well, we're awash with oil. In fact, he said we're up to our ears in oil and gas at the moment, and as indicated by the fact that oil and gas prices are at multi-year lows. Mr. McDowell's argument was that there's plenty of domestic reserves of both of those fuels, which will keep our economy going for a good long time yet. And given the risks that are associated with offshore drilling, then it's simply not worth taking that risk.
And I guess, was there also some concern that perhaps if there was success elsewhere, that eventually there might be some drilling closer to Delaware? If the door was opened by letting some drilling happen off the coast, eventually more would come, and then Delaware might be more directly impacted?
Well, indeed, there was. I had another conversation with Ernie Lopez, the Republican state senator for Lewis, and he made the point that that if adjoining areas were developed for oil and gas, then there was the possibility, and those areas proved either productive, or if they started to decline their production, then there was a concern which he felt was quite well founded, that that energy companies might seek to move into adjoining areas. And it's worth bearing in mind here that the Interior Department's planned area until this was cancelled, the planned area of ocean to develop started in southern Maryland. And so, it's not a whole, it's obviously not very far away from the Delaware coastline, as it might that energy companies might be tempted to move a little further north.
You mentioned this has been such an issue where the consensus was pretty broad across party lines. You've covered a number of different issues like this in terms of environmentally sensitive issues, from fracking to drilling like this. Is it rare to get this kind of widespread consensus or opposition to something in particular?
Well, in my experience, it is, and I guess that one of the things that stood out to me in this case was Senator Lopez, obviously a Republican, Republican Party, classically will support any measures that they think will be good for the economy and will boost jobs in the local area. But in fact, Senator Lopez said that he was unaware that there was any evidence that if this plan had gone ahead, it would make a significant improvement to Delaware's economy. This did seem to be a very unanimous view that this was a good thing.
You mentioned the jobs, obviously energy security, Harris McDowell had addressed. I guess that kind of separates maybe the drilling issue from what we oftentimes see when people talk about wind power off the coast, that people seem to feel like there's more potential job-wise for wind power off the coast for the places that are nearby than something like drilling.
Yes, I believe that's the case. But I think the folks that I spoke to on this will come back to is that even if there were some jobs associated, if there was a reasonable assurance of jobs that might be created as a result of an initiative like this, the risks of opening up such an area of ocean would outweigh, in their view, any economic benefits.
All right, John Hurdle, thanks so much for being with us on The Green this week.
You're welcome.
Again, John's piece on this story is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And next up on The Green, we check in with political reporter James Dawson about the goings-on this week at Legislative Hall. This is Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The use of bank settlement money was back in the news at Legislative Hall this week. Delaware Public Media political reporter James Dawson covered that story and much more going on in the General Assembly, and he joins us again this week to recap the week that was in Dover. James, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Tom.
Well, let's start off with that bank settlement money. The Joint Finance Committee has made a decision on what to do with that remaining bank settlement funding. After much haggling over what to do, the votes earlier this week, what did they decide to spend this money on after all?
Well, they decided to spend it on a lot of things, actually. So JFC doling out that $28.3 million is going into 17 different pots. Biggest highlights are significant chunks of money going towards two specific funds. One buys up deserted property, fixes it up, and sells it. And they're trying to strengthen neighborhoods that way to just get rid of this blight that might be used for drug dens and things like that. The other will pay for increased police patrols, street cameras, certain landscaping projects. Kind of make these neighborhoods a little bit more eye appeal, mm-hmm. curb appeal, and you've also got more money now going to a state housing voucher program rather than originally proposed. Two of the more controversial funds are going to bankroll pilot programs that will create after school programs for low income students, while another focuses on keeping those same students in line with their grade level readiness. Republicans say they're good programs, but they feel that earmarking this money will now obligate them to continue funding them in the future.
And that is, I guess, to some of the opposition this is seeing, not just on how to spend it, as you said, but also whether or not JFC has the authority to spend it on its own accord, right?
Yeah, so all four Republicans on JFC actually voted against the plan, even though some of them actually fought for and got increased funding for parts of it, the state rental assistance program in particular. So they're saying that it's unconstitutional to not bring this to both chambers of the General Assembly. Delaware's constitution does require a three-quarters vote on state funds being given to outside companies and nonprofits. And Senate GOP lawmakers sent a release out yesterday saying they're going to try and petition the state Supreme Court to issue opinion on the matter, though it's really hard to say whether that'll gain any traction since Democrats can control both chambers.
And I guess the other argument the Republicans were making was that they were going to the Supreme Court because you couldn't go to Matt Den because Matt Den's too tied up as Attorney General in what this money is being spent on. So they need to find a different venue for someone to decide this.
Well, especially because Attorney General Den actually did write an opinion on this saying, yes, I can spend this money in this way and it's perfectly legal. And they just don't buy it.
So it should be an interesting discussion going forward, though it appears more likely that the money is going to be spent this way going forward. That bill we talked a little bit about last week, sending incentives to Dow DuPont to bring a couple of the spinoff companies that are expected to Delaware, cleared the House, immediately signed by Governor Markell this week. So it is a done deal. But in the House, when it was voted on, there was some pushback. Tell us a little bit about what was going on there.
Yeah, it was minor but vocal pushback on that bill Thursday. So Representative John Kawako, who's always been staunchly opposed to these types of bills, calling them corporate welfare, spoke for several minutes during this debate. He went as so far as to say that the state is flushing money down the toilet, saying that these multi-billion-dollar companies really don't need this extra few million dollars that Delaware's kind of throwing their way. Only two other Democrats voted no on the bill. Only one other spoke. And then another representative, Paul Bomback, did not vote either way because he thought that this was a, quote, half solution because there was no real mechanism to fund these tens of millions of dollars that the state is giving out.
Another interesting bill released from a House committee this week was regarding the shackling of juveniles who are appearing in court. And it struck me as odd that this is still happening and it's something that's actually in need of legislation to change. What's the story with this?
Well, it doesn't necessarily need legislation to change. I spoke with the bill sponsor, Representative James Johnson, and he says that, this is court policy. It's not actually in state
right.
code, but he's just kind of doing the legislation to codify it and push it into a more permanent state. So really, right now, minors who are accused of committing crimes in Delaware, they go through family court. They don't go through superior court, et cetera, et cetera. But if they're not free on bail, they're transported to their hearings and kept in shackles while they're in there. So a nearly three-year-old internal memo among family court officials and others involved in the youth justice system did remove handcuffs and belly chains from this getup, like I said, about 3 years ago. But these defendants are still hobbled by leg irons, and they still have the main shackle cuffs that tie their hands to their feet. So the U.S. Supreme Court did in 2005 rule it unconstitutional for adults to be handled in this manner, at least carte blanche, and saying it makes them look guilty and it can hamper them from trying to write notes to their attorneys. But it's really not clear as to why this was never adopted by family court, since, like I said, it's not law. So this would make shackling an option if this kid's a flight risk or they pose some sort of danger. It passed unanimously from the House committee and is expected for a floor vote soon.
Yeah, it's just fascinating that it would be the younger offenders that are still shackled as opposed to older offenders. It seems kind of counterintuitive, but interesting. We'll keep an eye on that. Also, this week, the State Board of Education approved the WEAC Wilmington redistricting plan, sending it now on to the General Assembly for approval and funding. Any sense of how hard to sell this is going to be at Lake Hall, in particular the funding that the governor requested in his budget proposal?
Well, as you know, most education issues, and especially coming from the Markell administration, have been pretty hard sells at Lake Hall. But it's really tough to say at this point because there's been so much controversy around it, and we didn't have a completely concrete plan until this week. So stances have been fairly split among lawmakers that I've spoken to, but none of them who are against it sit on JFC. I don't think that getting the funding will be a problem. Since you pointed out, it's covered under the governor's recommended budget. It's $6 million out of a $4.1 billion budget, billion with a B. The hard part is going to be convincing enough lawmakers to vote for it in committee, and then if it gets out of committee on the floor.
It's just interesting. The one thing I think the folks at WEAC have learned is that they really do need to, and they've said this a few times now, in the last couple of weeks as they finally got things through the state board, that they're going to engage lawmakers pretty strongly on this issue. Dan Rich, the policy director for WEAC, saying that he thinks they should have support because everyone largely was on board to create WEAC. Now they just want them to support the work that WEAC's doing. That seems to be the tenor of the argument they're going to make, whether or not that works. In fact, we will see.
But that's the thing that's kind of was coming up with the State Board of Education. Everyone says that this is a problem. We need to address it. It's just once specifics come out, you know, hands are in the air.
It all goes in a different direction. Quickly, anything else on the legislative radar as we head into the final week before Easter break?
Yeah, something we could see and that we've been, at least I've been waiting for, is this new background check bill from House Majority Leader Valerie Longhurst. There were rumblings it was going to come out this past week, but it never surfaced. And what she says it will do is indefinitely put a gun purchase on hold if this National Firearms Database can't confirm that someone doesn't have a hold on their name. Happens in a small amount of cases, but these dealers can legally sell these guns after 3 days. So 92% of these are processed in that same time period in Delaware. But Longhurst says the state needs to be more cautious. And you can definitely expect some pushback once this is actually put into the system.
All right. James Dawson, thanks for joining us again this week on The Green.
Glad to be here, Tom.
And as always, you can find James Dawson's coverage of the legislature and all things politics in the first state anytime at our website, DelawarePublic.org. Next up on The Green, our arts playlist. Stay with us. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. While the Playhouse on Rodney Square is in the midst of its 2015-2016 season, it's already looking ahead. Last weekend, the venue, which is now managed by the Grand Opera House, unveiled a new expanded schedule for its 2016-2017 season. And in this week's Arts Playlist, we spent some time with the Grand's executive director, Mark Fields, talking about the Playhouse's next season and what the Grand has learned during its first year running the venue. So the lineup for this upcoming 2016-2017 season, one that should be pretty familiar to anyone with even a passing interest in Broadway, you guys have to be pretty happy with the lineup you put together to come to Wilmington this year.
We are very happy with it. I think it represents another advance in our efforts to bring Broadway and Wilmington back to the glorious experience that it has been in the past. And we have 8 shows that I think are going to make a really strong case that we're doing that.
Tell me a little bit about the season and the shows that are coming in.
Sure. Well, we have 5 full-week productions. This year we only had 4, so we've added 1 full-week production, and those are A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, Kinky Boots, Cinderella, Riverdance, and Pippin. And then in addition to those 5 full-week productions, we have 3 more shows that we are presenting as what we call a split, which is a weekend only. And those are Rent, which is another anniversary production, the 20th anniversary of Rent, believe it or not, Broadway Christmas Wonderland, and Once. What we're really pleased with, Tom, is 6 of these 8 shows are premieres for the Playhouse, and one of them, Riverdance, holds the record for being one of the highest grossing shows in Playhouse history. And on top of that, as if it weren't enough, and I guess it goes to this point that these are familiar titles to you, 4 of them are Tony Award winners for Best Musical, and 1 is Best Musical Revival.
You mentioned the expansion in the number of productions from overall 6 to 8, including 5 full and then the three splits. What was the reasoning behind adding a little bit more to both the full productions and the splits?
Well, what we see here is a great deal of interest. This series had kind of fallen on hard times for a number of years, and when we took it over, we had a sense that there was an audience out there for it. If we could improve the quality and improve the level of customer service and customer interaction, we've spent a lot of time and energy over the last 15 months developing a relationship with this audience, and we're very encouraged by the response that we've gotten to the shows that have played so far in this current season. We're halfway through our current season. We've presented Annie, Chicago, and Mamma Mia, and the audiences have grown steadily for each of those performances, and the feedback that we have gotten, Tom, has been really exceptional, and so it has given us the confidence to go even bigger, better, and bolder next year.
I want to ask you a little bit about the splits, and you know, what is, I guess, the benefit of kind of mixing them in for maybe people who aren't familiar as to why you would do something like that?
Sure. Well, it's it's a decision that we have made based on the history of the show, both what it has done here locally or what it has done nationally, as to which shows we think have the capacity to have an audience that's sufficient to sustain it over an 8 performance full week run versus a more limited run. And the shows that we're doing as splits are ones that we think there is clearly an audience for, but probably not the same level of demand as for the full weeks. And so rather than pay for a full week and extend that out and spread the audience over more performances, we'll just do a more compact commando hit and find the right level of audience.
Also, when you announced the season over the weekend, you also announced that you've added Bank of America as a title sponsor. How important is that to both the short-term success of the upcoming season and also establishing, you know, kind of the long-term possibilities and aspirations for the Playhouse?
Well, sponsorship is always important because all performing art is very human resource heavy by its very nature. You need artists up on stage performing to be able to bring an audience in, and that can be an expensive business. And when you're talking about Broadway shows with big casts and big companies and live musicians and all of that, these are expensive shows, and it's a risk for a nonprofit organization to bring these in. And so any time that we can mitigate that risk by having a corporate sponsor step forward and say, we think this is important for the community and we're willing to get behind it, that's a good thing. And one of the things that we're very pleased that we've done, Tom, for the upcoming 16-17 season is we've been able to lower the cost of tickets from the current season. And part of the reason that we were able to do that is that we knew we had this support coming from a corporate sponsor, but in addition to that, Steve Bailey, our marketing director, or our programming director, excuse me, has been working really hard to develop relationships with these producers and to get them to kind of share the risk in rebuilding this program for the audiences of Wilmington and Delaware.
I imagine that that's good news for you in terms of the ability to lower the ticket prices. Maybe it gives you the opportunity maybe to reach a few more people that you would not necessarily be able to reach.
Absolutely.
And make it more affordable for that average person. And I guess combined with the audience feedback you got last year, that's got to make you feel pretty good about that piece of the puzzle.
It absolutely does. I think we're positioned well to continue to build this program. And with the season that we've put together for next year, I think we're going to take a serious step forward next year.
Last year was the Grand's first year managing the Playhouse. What did you guys learn, and did it prompt any changes beyond the ones we've already talked about, maybe things that are just more about the way you handle the operation or audience engagement or any of the other pieces that aside from how many productions you're going to do?
Well, it has absolutely been a learning experience. You would think that performing arts is performing arts, but the reality is that Broadway operates very differently than the pop music and classical music and stand-up comedy that we present most of the time at the Grand. And so we have we've had a learning curve to deal with here, and we've had to learn a new audience. One of the things that surprised us when we took over the operation of the Playhouse is that there was very little overlap in audience between people who were going to shows at the Playhouse and people who were going to shows at the Grand, less than 20%. And that's really pretty astonishing when you think that these are two performing arts venues just two blocks apart on Market Street in Wilmington. But they had clearly different product lines and therefore very different audiences. And one of the long-term benefits that we see for having the Playhouse as a part of our overall operation of the Grand is that it's an opportunity to cross-promote these kinds of programs to two different audiences who we know already are interested in performing arts, but now maybe they're going to be willing to try something different. And so how we have learned this audience and what their expectations are and what their needs are. You know, we've been very open. We've been very communicative. We've created a dialogue and an opportunity for communication, and we have applied a lot of what we've learned to the season that we've put together for next year.
Were there one or two pieces of specific feedback you got that either prompted a change or kind of surprised you in I guess even their specificity?
Well, one of the initial assumptions that we had made before we took over the Playhouse was that the decline in audience was something that was based on just a change in consumer habits, that people were less willing to commit to more shows and a more rigorous subscription season. That's certainly the trend that you see across the country. People mm-hmm. want smaller packages. They're less inclined to buy subscriptions. They don't necessarily value saving that money versus having more flexibility. And so our assumption was that this audience was the same. And it turns out that that's not the case, that what the decline in subscriptions was really a result of was a perceived decline in the quality of the productions. And the audience told us that they were interested in more Broadway, not less, as long as they were strong titles and good productions of those titles.
And I guess if people want to know more about this upcoming season, buy tickets, buy subscriptions, tell us you know, how they can learn more.
Sure. Well, we have a website. It's theplayhousede.org, or you can call our box office at 302-888-0200.
And our thanks to Grand Opera House Executive Director Mark Fields for joining us on Arts Playlist this week to talk about The Playhouse on Rodney Square and its upcoming 2016-2017 season. And that's a wrap on The Green for this week. Remember, the stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head over to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We also want to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors John Hurdle and Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Eli Chen and James Dawson, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.